facing internal rebellion and the threat posed by German troops on South Africa's borders, Prime Minister Louis Botha and his deputy, Jan Smuts, led the Union Defence Force during the First World War. Botha, Jan Smuts and the First World War by Antonio Garcia and Ian van der Waag is a first-of-a-kind volume that investigates the wartime roles of these two legendary yet divisive historical figures. In this episode of PageCast, Antonio and Ian are in conversation with historian and author Karen Horn. Enjoy.
I am Karen Horn, a historian and author, and today I'm talking to two fellow historians, Ian van der Waag and Tony Garcia, about their new book, Botha, Smuts and the First World War. Okay, so Ian and Tony, for those who are not sure, could you give us an overview of who Botha and Smuts were and what their roles were during the First World War?
Sure, I can jump in on that one, and thank you so much, Karen. It's lovely to be with you here today. Louis Botha was, in fact, the prime minister at the time the First World War came around, and that's the first minister, the prime minister of the Union of South Africa. And Jan Smuts, who we often refer to as his second in command, he was also a minister within the cabinet, and then, of course, they were both also generals. And they had taken the helm of the Union at a very difficult time. 12 years before, maybe 14, depending on how you want to look at it, there was the Anglo-Boer War. And then there was a very difficult time in South Africa. And then from the late 1900s onwards, Transvaal starts having independence and then the Free State. And the Union gets formed in 1910, bringing together a lot of different factions, different parts or elements of South Africa. And they form the party that's really a broad church and brings together all these different interest groups. And by 1914, now a dominion of the British Empire, they go in on the side of Britain and go to war actively. And this becomes a debate in South Africa. And at that, if it's okay, Ian, I'm going to pass it over to you at this point.
Thank you, Tony, and thank you to Karen for chatting with us this afternoon about our new book that we feel very passionate about, you know, because of these two personalities. And Botha and Smuts, as Tony was saying, played such a critical role really in the early foundational history of South Africa as a country. Because it was under them really that the four territories that formed the Union of South Africa in 1910 were actually put into a position that they could form a new country. And essentially, the country's borders as they exist today, with one or two very minor changes, were drawn up at that point. So they're two very critical figures. And the kind of emotion that they still evoke today, I think, points to their continued significance on the domestic and even the international stage.
Okay, thank you. I think before we continue with the historical characters, I would like to ask something about your writing process. So the two of you are based in very far from each other. Tony, you are in Edinburgh, and Ian, you are in Abu Dhabi. So how did you approach the writing of this book?
The writing of this book, really took place over an extended period, possibly of as many as 10 years or more. I had a particular fascination with Smuts for a very long time, and I always wanted to do something of a reasonable size, maybe a book on Smuts. And Tony developed an interest in Louis Botha from his PhD dissertation. And the more we worked with these two figures, Botha and Smuts, the more we realized, in fact, that the two play off of each other, and that to fully understand the one meant you needed to understand the other. You know, you couldn't study the one in isolation, so to speak. And we can perhaps talk more about dual biographies too. But in terms of the writing process, these two paths that we walked and then eventually merged, of course, in the bringing out of this book, meant that we also visited, in the years before I arrived in Abu Dhabi, various archive repositories in different places, and Tony's PhD research, and after that, took him to a range of different places too. And I think this is one of the interesting things when it came to the making of this book in terms of the research base that we have, is the diversity and the range of material, and especially when it comes to personal papers, that we are able to bring. Yeah. If you'd like to add something to that, Tony.
No, I completely agree, Ian. We try to find the voices of these two really massive characters, and you know what it's like, Karen. You write on very important topics, and we have some overlap, maybe at different, even though it's different times in the history. Jan Smuts, there's a lot on him. He's written basically his own history in his time and across the board, from science to politics to botany, you name it. And also his colleagues up until the Second World War and after wrote about him, and he was famous in his time, basically a living legend in his time. And then we found, so just getting into a very nerdy conversation here, you know, I'm sorry if we're going to bore any listeners here, but for it was really finding the voice of Wörter that we found challenging, because he didn't have the diaries and the, I mean, if you look at the Smuts papers, the just incredible amount of correspondence with Issy and with, you know, everyone in the UK and, you know, everywhere around the world, his many friends and colleagues. But Wörter was a different person, and he was really a man of the earth and a farmer and a real practical man. And we also challenged the idea that he wasn't intelligent, you know, or he wasn't, maybe it's because he gets compared to Smuts often, but he was intelligent, and it was a practical intelligence. And what came from that was he didn't have the diaries, perhaps. But we had to look at his close associates, Preller, Engelenburg, Leitz, who he corresponded with in Amsterdam, and also some others. And that's where we tried to find his voice and who he was. And I think that's what that took some of the years that Ian had mentioned of trawling the archives to try and find that voice of Wörter. And we're not saying we've completely nailed it. Of course, there's a lot of space in this area, but we think at least we put a shot on the ground. And that was a lot of the process. And then some of it afterwards was, you know, more academic, more just logistical, dividing up chapters, who's the primary and secondary author on the different ones. But we've collaborated across all of it, and often supplementing, you know, it would be conversations like, you know, I'm, you know, Ian, listen, I think you need to help a bit more with the formation of the Union Defense Force, because of his immense scholarship in this area. And then, you know, Ian would feed over, you know, really interesting and cool tidbits. And I've got this from, you know, the Canadian this, or from the, you know, from Q, it was that. And then, and that's how we kind of bolted, Karen. So it was really that kind of collaborative process throughout.
Sorry, if I can just come off of the, you know, on the back of that again, you know, and I think we're both very aware, you know, that no books is the last word. No author sees all the material. We'd like to think that between the two of us, we've perhaps seen more than most, and we believe that in terms of some of the archival material, that may be true. But, you know, we have this idea of a rugby scrum. You know, it takes more than one person to drive that ball forward, you know, to the elusive, you know, historical truth line, so to speak. You know, and hopefully our aim here really is that we've driven the ball forward, you know, by a good distance, and we hope others will engage with this and obviously take it forward too, further forward.
Well, talking about the two different personalities, it seems to me that they're very different from each other, but you say they both believed in real politics. And then you say Wörter was, you describe him as an emotional man who was perhaps overly sensitive. So this must have been difficult for Wörter, especially in dealing with the 1914 rebellion. So what exactly was the working relationship between these two men? Did they get along? Did they have many disagreements with each other? And how did they reach compromises between, you know, when they didn't disagree with each other?
It's a very good question, Karen. And, you know, in our initial draft of the book, you know, I was a little bit cheeky on the one part, and I said they were really, you know, they got along really well. It was really a bromance. And obviously one of our peer reviewers picked up on it and, you know, got wrapped over the knuckles. Whoa, come on, get serious here. So, you know, that was really the kind of modern way to refer to it. It was a bromance. It was, and of course, we had to take it out of the book, but they were good friends, and they cared for each other, and they loved each other, as friends. They wouldn't socialize too much, you know, after hours, or we found limited evidence of that. But theirs was a true friendship, and it was a friendship of a shared vision. And it was really Boerter's vision after the Anglo-Boer War that mobilized Smuts. It's not the end of the road here. And, you know, one of Smuts's letters, he writes to his wife, he says, "I've just become plain old Smuts, not General Smuts anymore." And Boerter's the one that says, "Right, come on." And that was really the start of course, Smuts didn't take much, right? Like, his brain was incredible. He didn't need much, but he got his marching orders and maybe a bit of a subtle kick in the pants and said, "Let's get on with it." And you know, that was the start of it, or the real phase of their friendship. They knew each other before and during the war, of course, and they worked well together. But this was that new part of their friendship where Boerter was very, you know, complimentary about Smuts, and he really cared for him. And they supported each other. There was always a united front. Of course, with advantage, as historians have, we can read what wasn't meant for public consumption. And we can see at times where they disagreed, like in the German Southwest African campaign, where Boerter writes a letter to Smuts and says, "Thank you so much. I'm delighted that you're joining us. But about your plan, you are most definitely wrong. Now, let me tell you something. I have studied this country and I know the geography, blah, blah, blah." He says, "You should let someone else go in with a smaller force where you should stay back." So that's an isolated incident. He also said later, "If anything should happen to me, Smuts is in command." So, you know, where there was a close relationship with him, we can't take that as, you know, that he was publicly, you know, denigrating him or anything like that. No, it was a close relationship where they could speak frankly at times. There was a trust. And then, of course, there was a love, and he knew the abilities of Smuts. He shows his emotion, Boerter, where he says, in one letter, he says, "Oh, you know what?" He says, "Yanni, why did you send this? I've asked you to call me so-and-so, and why are you doing this? And put it through all the clerks in the Defense Force, you know?" And you see this kind of emotion. And Smuts doesn't apologize afterwards. You know, he just, you know. So they knew each other. And when he was on, one more thing before I pass over to Ian, one more thing I'll say, when he was in, when Smuts was in East Africa in command, Boerter writes to Issy and he says, "You know, just updating you about how things are going, you know, we're doing the best to support Yanni." And he says he's sending some stuff. But then back to Smuts, he says to him, I think your farm manager is giving too hard of a time to your wife. I don't want to get involved in your personal matters, but you must definitely fire him." And that's the last word on the matter. And also the tree contract. "I am here and I'm taking care of you," you know, and that was the end of it. And he sent some statues to the wife also, the two of them, to Issy. So there was definitely a love and in some ways he was a patriarch. But that's maybe where I'm going to end my speech on this one and pass the ball to you, Ian.
Thank you, Corin. It is a fascinating question. And it's one of the things that also intrigued James Rose Innes when he was Chief Justice of South Africa during the First World War, was this relationship between Boerter and Smuts. And Rose Innes, in fact, writes in his autobiography, you know, that in South African history, as no doubt elsewhere too, you sometimes find pairs of politicians running alongside each other, often an older person than somebody perhaps a decade or so younger. Also, the age difference between Boerter and Smuts. And we have several cases of this in South African history. If we look earlier in Cape history, for example, we've got Maltino and Saul Solomon cooperating in the build-up to responsible government for the Cape Colony. And then we have Sprigg and Uppington that followed them, and Rhodes and Hofmeyr too, before they fell out over the Anglo-Boer War. But of all of these pairs, Rose Innes found Boerter and Smuts the most, not only the most interesting, but also the most significant of all of them. And I think part of the reasoning behind this, as Tony was saying, was the men brought different things to the table. What they were wanting to achieve in the decades around 1910 and after not one of them would have been able to do alone. And I think they realized this. Huerta had certain very strong characteristics that Smuts simply didn't have. He had a heart, he had a big personality. He could drum up popular support. He was charismatic. Smuts, on the other hand, was colder, with a colder personality, perhaps more of an introvert, but with a brilliant Rolls-Royce mind. And he was an engine when it came to the administration. So they were very different people. And I think each realized that if they were going to achieve what they wanted in this new united South Africa, they had to work together. There was no choice. And they were almost the perfect running pair in many ways.
And they also had to work with the British after the Boer War. So there must have been something very different about these two ex-Boer generals than from the others who fought in the same war. How did they decide to support the British in the First World War, and what was the public's perception of that? Did they get a lot of negative feedback about that, and how did they cope with that?
Karen, I think that's a very good question, and something we tried to grapple with, you know, in a very objective and analytical way, you know, in the book, because we fully acknowledge there's a lot of strong feelings still about this matter. And, you know, we try to treat it with a lot of respect. And I think, you know, I don't want to say we succeeded, but I would like to say that I think we put in a good effort on it. So we looked at it not in the case of a bias that who should have, who would have, et cetera, but, you know, we acknowledge that after the Anglo-Boer War, there were scars that perhaps still haven't healed for everyone. And we, you know, we try and look at the many things that happened. For example, the Women's Monument in Bloemfontein, where we have, you know, where there's a mom holding a son, but she can't, you know, such a striking monument. The mom is looking away, but she can't bear to look at her son. And just using that as an example, that happened in a concentration camp in 1901. And then not even, you know, 14 or however many years later, to ask that same uncle, cousin of that person to fight for the person that did that, just using a microcosm on that one example, it's a big ask. And Huerta and Smuts very well knew that, because they were also impacted directly by the Anglo-Boer War, by the concentration camps. And our view, what we tried to put forward here from the evidence, was that they tried to do the best they could in a very difficult situation, emotionally charged, scarred society. And here we're speaking mostly about Boer and British or English South African. We acknowledge fully that there's a lot of different Black, colored, Indian interests in South Africa, and their views weren't coming to the fore at this point. There was marginalization. But between those groups in particular at the time who held the power, it was very difficult. And that South African party that was created by Huerta and Huerta's team, and Smuts, of course, included, they had to take into consideration all these many interests. And they saw their way to independence as collaborating with the British. And when I say collaborating, yeah, I mean this in the sense of working together. You know, if we look at, you know, the history, that word can be taken to mean different things. From the British side, they found in Smuts someone who was really educated at Cambridge. Some people said he was more British than anyone. And in Huerta, he became a darling. You know, they found him charismatic when they came to, you know, for a tour in England after the war, the Anglo-Boer War, and people got to know him and his charisma that Ian mentioned shone through. Because the Brits, after all, always respect a strong enemy. And the Boers gave them a stiff fight in the Anglo-Boer War. And so because of these relations, they realized this was a team we could work with. And then in the mid-1900s, when the Liberal government took over, it suddenly facilitated, because they were largely opposed to the Anglo-Boer War, it facilitated this type of independence, firstly in Transvaal, and then the formation of the Union in 1910. Of course, internally at the time, you know, the crises of 1912, 1913 with Herzog would play out. It would manifest these differences that, you know, the experiment of South Africa at the time, or the Union, the divides were just too big, you know, to pull these different groups together. It was, in some ways, it was an artificial union. And I think maybe at that point I can pass over to Ian maybe to add a bit more.
Yeah, thank you. I think those are all pretty important points to raise. But I think I would add the longer-term vision, you know, that Botha and Smuts had compared to perhaps men like Beyers and others who would eventually go out in rebellion in September of 1940. They had a longer-term vision, you know, in terms of this new country that they were creating. And countries aren't cast, you know, on the day of the union. There's a longer process. The casting process, you know, is, of course, far longer. It takes decades. And they considered, you know, where would South Africa be 10, 20, 30, 50, perhaps even 100 years from that point? And, of course, they didn't have answers to all of the questions, as Tony was saying. But I think both realized that the path to a better future for South Africa, and possibly one where the people of South Africa would be freer, even within the British Empire, and of course that eventually came in 1931, would mean that South Africa would have to fight in the First World War. There was no avoiding that. The right path for South Africa was participation in the First World War. Selling that to the South African public, of course, was a totally different question.
Yes, I got the idea, especially when you write that the Union was in many ways artificial, that they may have been far ahead of their time compared to the rest of the South Africans, especially the ordinary man in the street. So I think they must have had a difficult time to control everything that, not control, but to manage everything in the country the way they saw it compared to the way ordinary people saw the country going. And, you know, the two Boer republics sitting next to the two British colonies or the ex-British colonies, I can imagine that must have been difficult. But I think the main thing is that these two men were forward-looking, while many others in the country were, you know, looked backwards, which is something we might still find today even. But anyway.
That's a good point, Karen. If I can just jump in, I'm sorry to break your word, because we, you know, there was a short extract was translated for the Beeld, and when it was published, and you know, Ian and I, we found that very conversation that you had mentioned there. Mm-hmm. I mean, and only with my you know, Afrikaans tweedertaal, you know, I could kind of do my best to understand, you know, what was being said with the, and it was very much, it was a very polite, you know, discussion. There was no, you know, people, but just had their views, and it really echoed exactly what you said there, how people, you know, saw it differently. And I think we don't hide from the fact that there were staggering mistakes that Botha and Smuts made, and we call them out. But we also say that they've put South Africa on the world stage. It was something where, for good or bad, right? We're just saying that was done. And of course, you know, you mentioned this the question about how it came across, and I don't want to labor the point too much, but Botha was at pains about the Afrikaner rebellion. We mentioned in the book, we don't think he ever recovered from it emotionally. And you can see from 1915, after the political, after the general election, and you know, the kind of horse trading that has to happen afterwards, it's a steady downhill for Botha from there. And he suffered because he fought, and he saw you know, Burgers die in the field, like in Mushroom Valley. And True says, you know, the general was in tears and said, "You English will never know how hard this is for me." And I don't think that many people did. You know, I think he took it with him, and he struggled with it. And then with, you know, with Jopie Fourie, you know, it was being executed after being court-martialed, and getting that, even though, you know, Jan Smuts will take maybe more blame. But we did find evidence where Botha says, yeah, you know, it's not only him, it's me too. It's, and it was, you know, in one of the newspaper articles that we found it from back then. You know, one can only imagine how that must have cut on his soul, saying that out loud. you know, because he was a different man to Smuts, and he was, you know, he was very much advocating to let all the rebels go after the Afrikaner rebellion, basically. So it was definitely a difficult thing to balance, and he took it all to heart. So even though he had this forward vision, as Ian's mentioned, as you've mentioned, it weighed on him heavily.
So that's one thing that I appreciate of this book, is that you don't only look at the two men in their political sphere, but you also look at the personalities, the private person, and, you know, giving the reader some of that information, which I think is not, you know, I can't think of a book that made it available before. So that's something I really appreciate, because I think the man behind the political figure is perhaps more important than anything else. Getting back to the letters that they wrote to each other, do you think that Botha fully understood the risk of information falling into the wrong hands? Because he wrote all kinds of things to Smuts during the German Southwest Africa campaign, which I would have thought should have been, you know, classified information, and there it is in the hands of a postman to deliver. So, you know, did that, or, you know, was it not as sophisticated then as it is obviously now? But, you know, did he understand that he was taking a risk?
There are a couple of things there, Karin. You know, the one is the security of communications. So where you have a war theater, such as France, at the same time, where the infrastructure is better, the sea cables, you know, in terms of the telegraphic system, are more plentiful and they work better, you can then have a certain level of control over the communications, and you can secure them in ways that you cannot in one of the peripheral theaters, as they were called at the time. So the infrastructure for secure communications was just not there in East Africa, not in any way approximating the same levels that they had in France. So that was one problem, and most of the communications happened, of course, by dispatch. So these were dispatches that were delivered by a rider, often on horseback. So security was a big issue. Another thing too, of course, was, you know, what happens if something happened to the rider and his horse? You know, then the message simply did not get through. So you often had incomplete communications. This is another factor that one needs to consider. And of course, too, where the front lines are more flexible. In France, we have very fixed front lines once the stalemate had set in. So the possibility of your dispatches falling into enemy hands was far more remote. Obviously, the opposite sides had agents on each side of the trench that would try to intercept these things, but the possibility was more remote. In East Africa, where things were more fluid, we sometimes find, in fact, that a letterbox falls into the other party's hands. So no doubt these would have been worked through, they would have looked at everything, and we also have cases, in fact, where they rendezvous to exchange their letters. So this happened as well. Needless to say, these mostly have been personal communications, things that had no military value. You would have then, you know, from a gentleman's sort of side of things, you would then hand them over. So it was very different to the Western Front and yeah, in these ways.
And I find the idea of spies reporting to Smuts quite fascinating. Could you tell us more about that?
Well, Smuts established a very interesting intelligence setup. And South Africa didn't really have one, not the Union of South Africa, prior to this. And this intelligence network was set up at different levels. One, of course, was military intelligence. So this was information that you wanted on your opponent in the battle space. And here they could, of course, lean on the old Kruger system that had existed during the Anglo-Boer War. So lessons learned from 10 and more years before were, of course, drawn in. And I believe, too, that there was also personnel overlap. Somebody like Major Pitt Pretorius, for example, had a deeper intelligence career than we simply see in East Africa. But at another level, we also see, at a national level, we see Smuts also establishing a system for intelligence, which had more to do with the security of the state. And this was one of the areas where he and Botha perhaps differed. Botha didn't like this. He felt it was politically also not good. If the nationalists heard of it, it would be obviously political dynamite at the next election. But they went ahead, and from 1917, they established a small office that could communicate with MI5 as part of the larger British intelligence structures. So Smuts had a hand behind both of these things.
Perhaps, Tony, you could tell us more about the Battle of Delville Wood and the very, very long casualty lists that came back to South Africa from following that battle. Was this a time of crisis for Botha and Smuts? And how did they deal with it, especially in terms of the home front and people not all supporting the idea of South Africa participating in this war on the British side?
It's a good question, the question about casualties. And South Africa is sensitive to casualties in battle. And something, you know, not only in the academic space that we cover, but certainly in the military, it's something that we are aware of. You know, when I was serving, and if I can say maybe, Ian, the same for you. And we see that, and maybe I'm not sure if we make too much of it or not, but as a nation, and historically, we are sensitive to casualties. Within the context of the First World War, I think it was a little bit more nuanced than that. The question of recruitment was a challenge, and it's something that's explored, that we explore quite a lot in the book, because what we find is that the drive for recruitment, the initial interest in 1914, fades away a little bit. And people that seem to be very much for the war, such as in Natal, you know, very proud and strong, their recruitment numbers maybe aren't as high as what, you know, the rhetoric shows. But there was pride in not in the casualty list, of course, but there was pride in having participated in such a momentous battle in the First World War. It did establish South Africa's role, and I think Botha and Smuts played it sort of down the middle, that while being, you know, acknowledging the role and, you know, Lucan and the place that we had in this globe, in this massive force as in this global conflict, but also acknowledging the sacrifice of those that came or those that had passed in the war. And I think on that issue of remembrance is perhaps something we can do better in South Africa. I know, you know, besides a few parades and a few you know, military parades and a few events by very specific veterans associations, etc. It's not really remembered. It's not part of the public or the South African public consciousness when you compare to the rest of the Commonwealth or Europe. That's at least my view on it, you know, in terms of how we remember this war. If you compare, you know, the massive poppy campaigns in the UK, it literally takes over. Right. And it's cemented. Of course, the politics was different. Everyone generally, if I can say, everyone was supporting the war. It was completely mobilized. But yeah, so I think the memory, we can do more for the memory of those people. And Botha and Smuts at the time, I think they did their best to, you know, kind of play it down the middle. They were battling with a number of things. And, you know, the casualty lists of people who had volunteered for the campaign, you know, although tragic, and we acknowledge that it was an absolute tragedy, it wasn't going to be the thing that broke the camel's back or the feather. The nationalists, obviously, every opportunity they got would, you know, poke at it. You know, losing this, mm-hmm. what about that? But ultimately, it got subsumed into this bigger narrative. At least that's my view on it, you know, for now. Ian?
I certainly agree with that. The First World War is no longer really part of South Africa's national story. Doesn't form the same or fill the same place that it has, for example, in Australia and New Zealand, where the Anzac legend is really part of the foundational story of those countries. So the First World War plays a very different role for South Africa. And I think when we look back, we look at increasingly at the Mendi, and often not much beyond that, Mendi and Delville Wood, and that's about it. And I suppose part of the reason for this is that the country was recast again in 1994. So there was a second casting process, if we can put it that way. Yeah. And I think, you know, new countries need new stories and myths, you know, new history. And I think this is possibly part of it. But it is a bit of a wrestling process through which South Africa is going, because when one takes a look at the, over the last 5+ years, at the Smuts Must Fall campaign, for example, the fact that he still draws such controversy and animation from so many different sectors shows that, in fact, this process is incomplete. He's still very present. And in many ways, the First World War is perhaps more significant than many of us really want to acknowledge.
That's true. A last question to both of you. You say you would like to invite Werther and Smuts to dinner. What would you like to ask them?
So, yeah, we wrote that in the introduction, Karen, just as a, you know, kind of a thought experiment. You know, we said, because, you know, the whole discussion was, you know, you go through all these, and you well know, Karen, you go through all these books and archival sources and you pore over them. And sometimes you wonder, do we actually know the subjects of our book? Do we really know them? And so we thought, you know, it's kind of this thing, do you actually want to meet them? I'm not sure. And then the other part is, of course, we would love to know. And if we did, we mentioned, I mean, there are some unfair questions that we put in the introduction, you know, just for the sake of asking them. But we would want to know, you know, or see how, you know, Werther's charisma was in person, you know, maybe a smile, a wink, making eye contact, you know, listening intently. And you know, of course, this is proper nerdy things, you know, and we now it seems like we're praising them by saying that, you know, because the ones are philosopher warriors who we would listen to his stories. But also we say that we ask a very unfair question, and we said, could you have imagined the impact of some of your decisions in the future? And now, of course, this is only for, you know, we're going into counterfactual, and it's an unfair question, because they lived in their norms and we live in ours. But the idea was to kind of have this dialogue with the past, you know, and that's where we were kind of going. But yeah, that's what I would do. And I would also like want, although it's outside of the book, I would ask Werther a little bit more about the Tugela line in the Anglo-Boer War. That's just my nerdy interest on it.
I think those are interesting questions to pose and to get to know more of the two personalities. Only so much comes through in the documentation. But to talk to somebody and look them in the eyes, you know, when you talk to them, so to speak, not just through the documents that might be 100 years old, I think you get a very different feel for the person. But taking them out for dinner in 2024, for me, looking back over 100 years plus, I'd like to ask them, what do they make of the South Africa of 2024? It's vastly different from what they envisioned, necessarily so. And in order to bring through the successful making of a new country, looking back, how would they have approached possibly the whole nation-building project, which ultimately failed?
Okay, thanks, Ian. So that was Ian van der Waag and Tony Garcia, and I was speaking about their new book, Werther Smuts in the First World War. And as you know, the book is now available in all good bookshops. So go and get it. It's a very good read. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of PageCast. We love hearing from you. So if you'd like to get in touch, please contact us at pagecastpodcast@gmail.com. Until next time, keep reading and listening.